It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy Fanny Show.
Interview with Eric Orchard, a.k.a. the Cloud Cartographer.
I'm Sean.
I'm Mike.
And our special guest today is Eric Orchard. Hello, Eric.
Hi, guys. So glad to be here.
So we should probably take a minute since I'm pretty sure you are the first person we've had on specifically for a graphic novel. So, I'm pretty sure you're the first.
It's very cool.
Which is awesome. So yeah. I thought it would be a really good time to start off by actually having you tell us a little bit about your sort of artistic journey, how you got to being this award-winning illustrator and cartoonist.
Oh, gosh. Just so much work. I started off in children's books, so I began my journey doing, I was doing mini comics in high school, and I would share them out with friends and mail them out internationally, and I was about 16, 17 when I was doing that, and so that's a great way to start. This was before web comics, so I was big in the, I'd go to like local music shows with my mini comics and sell them there and do things like that, and then I went to art school. And I got a painting degree, and I went into children's books. And when I was doing my first children's book, I still had this real longing to do comics. So I started doing these mini comics about this character called Maddie Kettle. And I would just do one after the other. I would just have so much fun doing them. And I did them for a couple of years. And in the meantime, I was starting to get comic book jobs. Like, First Second got me to do some anthology work, so a short piece for them. I would do a short piece for the Yo Gabba Gabba anthology for Oni Press. So I was doing these little bits and pieces. I was doing a lot of illustration work. And then after that, I sent one of the mini comics to Top Shelf and a few other publishers. And Top Shelf took the bait and agreed to publish my book. And that's how I got there.
Well, it's interesting. So you actually started out with sort of mini comics with Maddie Kettle, and now we have this full, I guess it would be a full book in graphic novel form, since I guess in regular novel form a full book would be like 10,000 pages these days. So
the editor's gone.
So the question I'd actually like to ask is, since you've started with that shorter scale, what was the kind of journey to get to this much broader narrative scale, since we're dealing with two different levels, sort of like jumping from like doing a comic strip to like writing an actual narrative?
Well, gosh, so much of it has to do with confidence, just sort of believing that you can actually hold something together of any significant size, because I was only used to doing these little things, like 10, 20 pages at most. But I did have the narrative in my head, and I knew it would take about 100 pages to tell it. And it's actually, I should say now, Maddie Kettle is an ongoing series, so it does continue in another book after this. But it was a confidence issue, so I just had to feel my editor at Top Shelf, Chris Steros, really gave me the confidence to be able to tell a 100-page story and really get me started, and gave me confidence in my storytelling ability. That's such a big thing, really. And, I had done so many mini comics that the story started to link up. I started to just have this strong desire to tell a longer tale.
We can hear Munchkins.
Yeah, someone's having a bath.
Oh, okay.
Oh, it's fine. We're talking about what is this essentially like a graphic novel for children.
Yeah.
And there are children in the background, so it's very fitting.
While I work, there's children at my feet all day, most days.
So just a curious question. I'm assuming they're your kids. You're not like just
in the... I have two young boys.
Because it would be a little awkward, like you're doing interviews in like a random room with other children.
I know. No, I could see that possibly happening, but no, they do belong here.
But out of curiosity, I mean, you must share your work to some degree with your own children. Mm-hmm. What is their kind of reaction? Just out of curiosity to your work.
That's interesting because it's not what I would have expected. They'll walk up to strangers in the street and say, "Have you heard of Maddie Kettle?" And the oldest will do that, like things like that. And you know, the oldest is six; he just turned six. So he's not really old enough to grasp what's going on. And he wasn't even born yet when I started doing Maddie, when I first started doing the minis and stuff. So it's interesting to bring them into that creative process and to work with them around, because I love doing kids books, but I had started before I had kids. So yeah,
that's great. That's great. Mike, do you have a question? Do you want to jump to?
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on that. How do you think your view of kind of writing Maddie as a young person has changed as you've kind of helped raise children into kind of young humans?
Yeah, I find it pushes things like my optimism in the world and my philosophies to the fore. Like I really want to, the things I want my son to have, I almost subconsciously put into the stories. Cause I have sort of an optimistic view of the world. And it just ends up, I think, even more so being put into the books. But it's funny because I can't say 100% what impact my kids are having on my work. Yet it's almost like I'm going to have to look back and see, because it doesn't feel like it's a huge impact yet. It feels like, they're doing their thing and I'm doing my thing, you know, they write their stories and I write mine. And it just feels like we're separate creative people under the same roof.
So I know, Mike, you have a question that's going to dovetail really well with what Eric was saying about having an optimistic worldview. But I did want to just take a moment to talk about the wording of your actual question, Mike, because you were very specific about him raising young humans as opposed to something else. So I appreciate that specificity, because I guess he could have been raising young goblins or anything else.
Oh, well, I apologize if I made misraced your misspecified your children. I did not mean to offend.
Not at all. I have a young parrot I'm raising as well. So I mean, you could have been talking with them. That's fine.
So Mike, I know you really would like to ask that question that really fits in with that optimism line. So why don't you go ahead and ask that question?
Yeah. So kind of the biggest thematic through line that I found in Maddie Kettle, the first one, was that even the antagonists who had done bad things to Maddie or to other characters were not really all bad, and that they had done bad things accidentally or because they'd been put in bad circumstances. Can you talk a little bit about kind of the decisions that went into how the villains / antagonists built the story and kind of their moral landscape?
Yeah, I just sort of, you know, that all came out in the story, and I think it was more revealing of my own sensibilities. To me, I was surprised myself to see where these things went when I was just following the story, because that's just how it made sense to me. And I think, you know, in a day-to-day basis in your own life, you know, when you see villains, you know, or someone you have a disagreement with or some difficulty with, often that is the case. There are really rotten people in the world, obviously. But I think on the whole, you know, I do find that, you know, people do, there is something good at the core. Sort of it almost sounds like a Buddhist thing, but it was just sort of, it's essentially where the story led me. And I can see later on in the story where I'm going to talk about things that are maybe, you know, like themes like greed and selfishness that lead people to really drop their humanity. But I think in that first book, I wanted to stay in that zone of peeling back and seeing the good in people.
Yeah, I think it's a really strong kind of initial moral thematic thesis statement, and it was very heartwarming for me.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I agree, because it's it's been a while since I've intentionally read a book meant for kids. Mm-hmm. And realizing that there is a distinctive shift in the kinds of tone that I'm used to. Because mm-hmm. a lot of adult fiction is, I mean, some of it is optimistic in a kind of very broad sense in the way of your work, but most of it, like, it's dealing with, like, really horrific things happening in the world and, like, heroes overcoming those kinds of things. Whereas this book is, some bad things have happened, although the bad things that have occurred are fairly minor and turn out, as Mike was suggesting, in some cases, like, to have been complete accidents. And not the acts of evil, as it were.
And I may have been responding to that to some degree because I've, you know, since I sort of petered out collecting comics in the 90s when Grim and Gritty really hit its full stride. And I just got really bored of that aesthetic. And I do find I respond, maybe not totally consciously, but when I do write, I do my comics, I do maybe respond a bit against that, push against it a bit, because I find it is overused now.
Yeah, I would agree. I was thinking, as soon as you started talking about comics, about the grittiness of comics, the thing that I thought about was the most recent Avengers string of comics,
right.
Starting with the Marvel Now, which
is
pretty gritty, but also does some really interesting things where, like, the villains that we thought were the villains turn out not to have actually been villains at all, and it's this alien other thing that is coming, which I thought was really fascinating because, you know, here I am expecting, like, all of the superheroes are going to gather and they're going to have this big fight fest and, like, a city is going to get massacred, and that's not what happens.
Yeah. I think in mainstream comics, too, there is a little bit of a response against the grim and gritty aesthetic as well. I think it's sort of slow to happen, but it's sort of building up steam.
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, this push to get a little bit more optimism, I guess. And it's really hard, I imagine, to write something like The Avengers as being just sort of dark and grim and gritty because these are supposed to be heroes. They're supposed to
be
the good guys, but But any case, so another aspect of this that I really loved about Maddie is it is a really weird world. There are, just to give a couple examples, because it's short and I don't want to spoil too much, there is a like, spidery, like, castle place that it's located in a special place, I won't say where. Mm-hmm. There is a bear and a, oh gosh, what is he?
Raccoon.
He's a raccoon, right, who fly in a hot air balloon, charting clouds.
Yep.
Which is easily your ticket to having a what do you call that? What do you call it when you have like a spring-off show?
Spin-off?
Spin-off, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, because
Harry and Silvio,
They're adorable.
Yeah.
So you have all of these like really weird kind of bizarre elements, which maybe they're just weird. They seem weird to me, but maybe they're completely normal from like a child's imagination. Like they would really think a raccoon in an air balloon. Why not?
Yeah, well, it makes sense to me. I think it's just the way I think. I have this really, like, I read a lot of kids' books. It's mainly what I read. And I have this really, I've always, you know, kind of dwelt in that world of, and thought like that. Sort of, children's books have had a huge impact on the way I think, I believe. So, it, to me, that sort of oddness, I think, comes kind of naturally. And it's interesting that you talk about Harry and Silvio being a spinoff because they were a separate mini comic. I had done a Maddie Kettle mini comic and a Harry and Silvio mini comic, and the comic finally came together when I combined the two stories.
I want both of these things.
Yeah.
I love those characters. They're just adorable.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mike, do you have another question before I just sit here and gush for an hour?
Well, I can kind of jump into some of the art aspects.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah.
Yeah, and because when I was reading and looking through Maddie Kettle, my mind leapt to a few different art styles or artists. I thought a little bit about Goodnight Moon. I thought a little bit about Van Gogh's Starry Night, especially in the brushwork.
Good catch. Most people don't get that. That's good.
Cool. And I wanted to ask if you could maybe talk a little bit about artists who've influenced you in general, and if there are any influences that you think are specifically applicable to Matty Kettle.
Oh, sure. Well, I think the Van Gogh is a great catch because I love the way Van Gogh will do sort of this directional hatching in his drawings and his paintings. So that was a big influence. One big influence is Maurice Sendak, and especially his pen and ink work. So he did like Where the Wild Things Are and, you know, Higgledy Piggledy Pop and all those classic children's books, In the Night Kitchen. So those are big ones. Arthur Rackham, who is a early 20th century illustrator, late 19th century, early 20th century Edwardian era illustrator. And he's a big influence as well. One of my biggest. I reference a lot of Edwardian work in my comics. I'm a really big fan of older illustration, and I collect books from that period, and you know, and also the mid-century illustration as well, like the Provincians and like Sendak and Mercer Meyer and others. I'm a big illustration nut, and I have like bookshelves just weighed down with illustration books that I reference every day, and I go through and I just absorb this stuff.
Very cool. Yeah, I'm familiar with Rackham, but only in the vaguer sense, and I know some of Sendak's work better. Yeah. But both, you know, all of those names kind of ring bells for me, and it's now making me want to go back and like ask my parents if they still have any of my old children's books. A lot of them got passed down to my sister, who's 12 years younger.
But, well, it's good that you keep getting read, right? Like, that's the point. Yeah. So.
Did you have another question, Mike, or do you want me to jump in?
My other questions were a little bit more on kind of the process side. So if we want to stay content.
Okay. Yeah. Just for a little bit longer, and then we can definitely tackle the process side, because I'll be very interested in that as well, because comics are awesome. So as a renewed comic reader who may have gotten a little obsessive, you know, comic collection's fun. So just to kind of talking about the narrative style, this is, I likened it on the one hand to kind of like a fairy tale, and I'm not sure if that was an influence that you drew from, because I know you say that most of what you read is obviously children's books, so that's clearly a very obvious influence. I mean, for both, just because you read it, that's an obvious sense, but also because you're writing children's books, so it makes sense that you're borrowing from that tradition. Did you draw from any sort of fairy tale sources? Was that something that you intended to do here?
Yes, but more the feeling and less any specific fairy tale.
Okay.
Like, for instance, you know, one of the things that happens in the story is Maddie finds a flying boat in the desert, and to me that's a very fairy tale concept. And I just try to get that tone, that fairy tale tone, and folk tale tone. Like, I'm a big fan of Mike Mignola as Hellboy, and he really pulled, especially in the non-grand narrative stories, like his early on, like smaller stories, like The Chained Coffin and The Corpse, he was pulling pretty much directly from fairy tale sources. And another times he would just have this feeling of a fairy tale. And I really like, you know, and Neil Gaiman does this as well. Just sort of, I think when you've read enough fairy tales, and I've read a lot of fairy tales, it just starts to inform the tone of your work. So I think that's mostly what's happening with fairy tales and my relationship to them, is that I just read so many that the tone just seeps into my work, rather than intentionally attempting to incorporate fairy tale ideas or themes into the books themselves, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike jumped in with a hand there, so Mike has a follow-up to this.
Sure.
Yeah, so I've got a bit of a folklore background, and I didn't study fairy tales as much directly, but a lot of my friends and colleagues did. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they talk about for, and this is for some versions of fairy tales, since there's just, you know, there's lots and lots of incarnations.
Yeah.
But that oftentimes in fairy tales, you'll get very flat affect from the leads.
Yes. Yeah.
But I feel like in Matty Kettle, in getting to see her facial expressions, we get much more of a depth of affect. Yes. Can you talk a little bit about that contrast, maybe?
That's interesting because someone else was pointing out how Harry and Silvio have kind of flat onomotive faces. So there might be that as well. Like that might, it might come out in the fairy tale creatures. Whereas Maddie, I was so intent on just capturing the look of a, you know, 11-year-old girl and sort of the faces that they make. And I think that's where I was coming with that. And I think I tried to get the sense of mystery and strangeness of a fairy tale more in the backgrounds and the themes. Mm-hmm. And I allowed sort of Maddie to be more emotional and a little more emotionally real in a sense. Because sometimes a fairy tale can feel sort of, there's a detachment in the way the characters respond to things. And I wanted Maddie to respond in this very real way. And so that's my sense there.
Yeah, and I almost got the sense that Maddie was drawn and depicted one step more toward the realism end of a cartoon, fully cartoon and iconic to fully naturalistic scale than the other characters. Was that kind of an intentional play to go along with the 11-year-old girl, or kind of how do you make the decision of where on that spectrum to put characters?
It wasn't intentional. It just sort of, the characters just sort of dictate themselves how they look, and I sort of play with it as though I have a bunch of toys and I'm telling a story. and it's the same as playing with my action figures when I was little. And it's very much like that. I'm just dealing with what I have, and those characters very much want it to be the way they were, you know?
Something else, kind of jumping on the fairy tale wagon here. Yeah. I like that. That's a great title.
Fairy tale wagon.
That's good. Yeah. Copyright Sean Duke 2014. because another aspect of the fairy tale, I mean, a great deal of, and I'll speak just from the Western perspective because I'm not very familiar with fairy tales outside of that perspective, but a great deal of the classic fairy tales, they don't end very happy. And a lot of them are essentially authoritarian sort of tales about, you know, you violate some sort of social rule, bad things happen to you, which is why you shouldn't violate those rules.
Right.
Here, we get the complete opposite. In fact, without revealing any details, by the end of the story, we have, I guess, a thematic element of adults sort of realize, or maybe the Maddie sort of realizing that adults don't actually have all of the answers, and kind of that. Not necessarily a coming of age necessarily, because she's still 11 at the end, but there is that feel of that kind of that optimistic push towards something that escapes that fairy tale mode where she's breaking the rules, but that actually turns out to be the best option for her.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I found that curious in the book because I'm very, you know, I look very conservative. And I think I have this, I think I have this authoritarian streak in me that comes out in my work that maybe isn't in my daily life. that is a heavy theme in the book where, you know, Maddie sort of rejects what her parents want to do and she rejects what, you know, she works with people and rejects what people tell her she must do. And I think that's such an important part of childhood too. Though, you know, if you did look at fairy tales, if you look at like the Jack stories, he's like this lazy guy who doesn't do what anyone wants him to do, and he kind of gets along on luck and a good heart. And I think there is that in fairy tales too, but because it came out of an era that was authoritarian, like it came out of an era that had a time of non-constitutional monarchies where they were one step down from God, you know, and these were stories of the people. It was tricky to sort of be really, you know, in these oral storytelling traditions, it was probably tricky to really poke fun at the authority, but I think it's in there. I think it's in the fairy tales. It doesn't always seem that way. Like sometimes it's hidden, but I think there is that in fairy tales. If you poke a little deeper.
Interesting. Okay. I'll have to do some more reading.
Well, that wasn't that. I certainly didn't mean that as a slight on your reading.
No. I mean, fairy tales is not my academic field, but it is something that I've read on and off through going to college. Like, you take a literature course occasionally, you get to some fairy tales, but going back to them, maybe now that I'm old, it might change. Yeah,
it could be too that I'm just reading them differently than you. Fairy tales are very open, and you. They're so open that, they're basically, a lot of fairy tales are just, three things repeated through a story and with a dark ending. It's sort of, they're very basic, and I think they're very easy to read into, and I might be just projecting, but I don't know. I'm not sure. I like to think that there's an anti-authoritarian streak going through these oral stories, but who knows?
Yeah, because in most fairy tale, or in a lot of fairy tales, you get the declaration of the interdiction. Don't do this thing. Don't go off the path. Don't go into the woods. And Maddie runs into these interdictions and goes past them, but finds a new truth out of it, I don't think of as being as much the way that a fairy tale type tends to work. More frequently see, here's an interdiction, you violate the interdiction, and you get the predictable result.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I see what you're saying. It's absolutely true, yeah.
But there's also that element, too. I mean, something you mentioned, the fairy tale as being a more open world. And I think that's the tone that you were talking about earlier is when you go through, when you're reading Maddie, things occur that are strange and bizarre, but they're like matter of fact. They're just a part of the everyday kind of occurrence. I mean, Maddie is scared at one point by a snake, which I thought this was adorable. She's like, the snake scared me, and the snake says sorry, and it's like no big deal. In any other context, if it were, 19th century story in which a snake started talking, like there would be a long diatribe about how this is like Satan and all these kinds of things. Maybe not the 19th century, maybe a little bit earlier, but but there is that kind of that openness in the world that you've created in which things just sort of, they just are.
Yeah. I think, to some degree, I'm reflecting how I felt as a child, and you just sort of, everything is so strange, and you just kind of, it just kind of flows over you. You take a walk through the woods and you see these, you see crazy looking mushrooms or, a weird twisted tree, and it's just everything, and grown-ups seem so weird when you're a kid. They can seem like monsters. But the stuff just, no one acts like it's nuts, so you just deal with it. None of the other kids are freaking out, so it must be normal, so you just kind of go along with it. And I think that's just sort of my own feelings about the world, and it just comes out sort of naturally in the story.
You made me think of two real world examples, because as soon as you start talking about kids, like they see monsters, there's actually, I don't know if they have, imagine they have it in Canada, but there is a commercial for, I want to say it's like for an Audi or some car where there's a kid in the back of the car and they're driving by all of these things. Like they drive by a tree and a branch falls, but like we all see the branch fall, but then the kid sees like a tree monster. All these kinds of things are occurring where, these sort of fairy tale things. And then the other example I was thinking of is sort of that childish mentality. Like when I was a kid, I recall like I would have G.I. Joes, but then I would have all these toys from other universes, like other game universes or whatever. And they would just all play together. There'd be no concept of you can't have crossovers. Like that, no concept of that. Like I'll put a G.I. Joe on a fire truck and like throw him down a slide and like laugh at how he falls. Right.
Yeah.
Like that kind of intermixture, that mentality of that childish mentality is like really an open.
Yeah.
Sort of, it has no limits.
Yeah. And I try to keep that alive in my own writing. I know exactly what you're saying, and I'm conscious of that, and I try to foster that a bit, because I think it's a fun place to be and a fun way to approach the world, and I try to encourage that in my stories as well. So that's a big thing. That's a major theme as well. That's actually a more conscious theme to me than a lot of other things that people have picked up on. Like I'm aware of how I see the world and how it's in Maddie.
That's awesome. That's a good way to see the world.
Yeah.
We need more people who have that. We would that's be on problem. Mars right now if we had that.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly like there's Ray Bradbury talks a lot like Ray Bradbury really saw the world that way, and he was just so frustrated that we weren't on Mars because he was just like, this, where's our imagination? This doesn't make sense, you know, and it's this impatience with the world.
Oh, I agree with that. I find it deeply unsettling.
And, yeah.
You know, it's just like there, because science fiction in particular, like, had all these grand visions of where we would be by 2000. And here we are in 2014, and it's like we put some robots on Mars, which is cool. That's really cool. Yeah. But, like, you know.
The only planet populated by robots.
The right? only.
That we know of.
That we know of. Yeah, there might be one out there. Who knows? It's just kind of, it does feel, I think Neil deGrasse Tyson talks about that a lot.
Yeah.
Where he'll bring up this, you know, like, where's our imagination? And then he'll look at places like in the U.S., like looking at the Congress and looking at the kinds of people who get jobs and not the kinds of people in terms of like their personal politics, but like what they were before they became politicians. And it's, you know, it's like lawyers and like career politicians and things.
Right.
And he's like, where are the engineers and where are the scientists? And, you know, these, like, where's, like, the literature professor who, like, writes crazy fantasy stories? Like, all of these people aren't part of that process.
Yeah, you're right. And I think because of that, we respond a lot out of fear when we move society forward. We do it in a very fearful way and without a lot of excitement. And I think it's troubling sometimes. We really do need to foster imagination in people. And that's, you know, one great reason to do kids' books, I have to say.
Yeah, that I agree that we are more likely to react out of fear, which is unfortunate. I mean, because like I know people who I've seen people like there was a thing I don't know a couple weeks ago where it was like China unveiled its high speed rail plan about how it wanted to connect China to Europe through this rail line, and like my first reaction was that is freaking awesome
because
it looks amazing, and I'm like that's great, like let's do it, let's make it happen. Because that would be so awesome. Like, you could go from Paris, France, and then go to Shanghai.
Amazing.
Like, in like a day or something.
Yeah,
you know? I don't know how long it would take, but, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, then there are people who react like, oh, my gosh, China's taking over the world. And I'm like, no, it's awesome.
Yeah.
So why don't we have a space elevator? Where's my space elevator? Dang it.
I know.
Well, clearly the solution is for everyone to buy Eric's books, and then the next generation will have amazing imaginations, and we'll get to Mars.
It's a good first step.
Mike, I think it would be a good time to kind of jump to some of those process questions because I think it would be good. But otherwise, we'll spoil stuff from the book, and I don't want to do that because I like the book and I want people to buy it.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. So, Eric, for you. It seems like in previous bits of the conversation that you've got a little bit of a kind of a discovery process where kind of things emerge. Can you talk about like what parts come or, you know, is it more story and then visuals or do the visuals help you find through the story? And is that different in your creator owned work versus places where you're maybe collaborating?
Yeah, that's a tough one. Okay. Let me just get myself together here. So you're asking, like, what part of the process comes first?
If you kind of discover things through as you're going, do you tend to think through, like, do you kind of sketch to think through things?
One big thing is because this was my first graphic novel ever. Mm-hmm. A lot of it was discovery, trial and error stuff. It took me a really long time to do. Because I had to do other work at the same time, so I didn't have the luxury of just concentrating on it. But also, I wasn't 100% sure on how to do a graphic novel. So, you know, like so much of it was just figuring out how you do a graphic novel, like how you do this story, and finding what comes first and what comes next, and so many of my concepts. It's interesting because it's not like I have this idea and I freak out and I have to make a book out of it. Oftentimes an idea will be percolating for years because it's just not quite right yet. And by the time I figured out what to do with this idea, I'd forgotten where the idea came from. And that's a really common thing with me. So with Maddie, I think it started with characters and scenes. And then the story kind of grew out of that. Because I'm most concerned about having a cohesive story. I felt like I had the other stuff. I felt like I had the characters. I felt like I had some cool scenes I wanted to draw. And I knew how I wanted to draw it. But I think the characters and some of the scenes and the basic feel of it came first. And then the actual story, figuring out what actually happened and how it got to this place, that came second. And right up until I was drawing it, I was still figuring out what was happening.
Okay. And what would you say was one of the biggest kind of takeaways that you came upon or decided upon in terms of this is how I tell this graphic novel or tell graphic novels in general?
Yeah. Well, that's a tough one. Yeah, that's tough.
We can loop back around to that one later if you want.
Yeah, why don't you give me a second to sort of, because that's something I haven't gone there yet. I haven't really thought much about that, but that's a really good thing to think about. And so, yeah, why don't we come back to that in a bit?
Sure. Can you talk a little bit about like medium and the kind of the nitty gritties and, you know, painting, digital, lettering?
Yeah. Well, it's done in pen and ink. I did it all on Mayfair or Bristol paper. I drew Maddie with like a dip pen. I did all the outlines with a dip pen, something called a G pen, and all the hatching were done with those little Pigma markers. So it's very, I have these very, like the final pages have so much ink on them. They're so heavy. I did it in the most primal way, just pencil, pen and ink and paper. And I want it to be really basic. Because I do have a tendency to experiment and to try new things, but because this was my first book, I thought I'd keep it really basic. The cover is done in gouache, so there was a bit of experimentation there. But for the most part, it was just very basic drawing. Like I just wanted to do the most basic, straightforward drawing I could do. I'm doing a book with First Second now, and that's a little more experimental because I incorporate watercolor and more brush and ink into it as well. I think, you know, I actually have thought of a good answer for the takeaway question too.
Sure. And do you hand letter as well?
I don't. I wanted to hand letter, but my publisher wanted to do it digitally. So I let them do that. And someday I'd like to hand letter, but my lettering is kind of messy.
Yeah.
I want it to be as legible as possible. So I just went with that.
Yeah, because as I was looking back and it was like, wow, this lettering is really consistent. I'm like, I don't want to assume that it's digital because then I might offend him. Would be so much work to do 100 pages in really consistent lettering, because I think the font is a great, somewhat whimsical match.
Yes.
Like, did you talk with your editor on font choice, or did they be like, did they say, we think this is the best font?
No, it was a huge ordeal, and a lot of discussion went into that, actually. Maybe more discussion than the actual design of the book, because we really had to get it right to fit with the art, because the art has so much personality, and it looks so handcrafted. Mm-hmm. That the lettering was so important to get it to match the aesthetic of the book. And we went back and forth for more than a month, sending out like examples of lettering and seeing which we felt. And sometimes I would like it and the publisher wouldn't. We worked with the designer Chris Ross at Top Shelf, who was just brilliant. And Chris Steros was the editor, who was also brilliant. And we just talked it over for ages until we all felt we had something that was comfortable, that looked sort of hand drawn, but was consistent.
So can you unpack kind of what your designer did for the book and kind of what the designer's role versus an editor's role is and how that all interplays?
Sure. Well, the designer basically exaggerates the package, the aesthetic that I created in the package of the book. So I was going for this almost Edwardian, very much referencing the history of children's books and illustration. And Chris was very aware of that. Chris Ross was very aware of that in our discussions. So he looked for fonts and binding that would look appropriate to that aesthetic. And, you know, it's funny because, like, it's so good. Like, good design, you barely even notice. And you barely notice, like, the design in this in a way because it looks like I did everything because it's mm-hmm. all my stuff. But he put it all together in this amazing way that really exaggerated and complemented the full aesthetic that I was going for with my art. The editor, Chris Steros, who is sort of top shelf secret weapon when it comes to editing, he's amazing, and he's really not known for his editing. And we spent literally months going over the story and discussing it, and until it was somewhere that we thought it was just perfect for us. And he also, you know, early on was rejecting art. He was like, no, it's not good enough. Try again. So he pushed me to do the best art I could do on this and to do the best story I could do until.
And you were. Sorry. And you were speaking with him on story and structure before most of the art was happening?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So before any of the art started, we talked about story and structure all done in outlines, like all prose outlines. And we batted back and forth this prose outline for months.
Cool. And how do you kind of break down your page by page and panel by panel? Do you do thumbnails, or you just kind of work by feel?
It's thumbnails. So mm-hmm. before the book was even done, it was all laid out in markered thumbnails. I did them in a Sharpie, and then I did it on my Cintiq, which is a drawing computer mm-hmm. In Photoshop. So, yeah, I did it. I really got the whole thing. That's a big part of my process now, is to ensure that I know exactly what I'm doing, because you get into the flow of drawing and you don't want to be tripped up by having to revise something too heavily. So you want to be very comfortable that you have the story you want to tell in hand. In some form. And actually, picture books are done the same way. So I was very familiar with that process. When you do a picture book, you do a dummy book before you even start the book. So it's all the artwork and the cover. And, you know, it can be very, like, rough. It doesn't have to be perfect. But you have an idea of every step that you have to take to complete the book. And I find that essential to my work.
Very interesting. Has there ever been a time when you kind of found something new in a panel or in a page that kind of changes from the outline?
Yeah, there has. In fact, in my new book, this has happened. And in Maddie, I found I would have to add or take away a panel because either something was extraneous or it needed another beat. So I have added panels and just little things like that, though. I'm always rethinking the dialogue, so that changes right up until the end as well.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's not done until I let it go. Until, you know, it's off to the printers, that's done. But up until then, everything's malleable. You know, it can keep changing.
Very much like a writer.
Exactly. Yeah.
I did things that were more substantial than maybe I should have during the page proofs of my last book, but my editor was a complete hero about it. So it's good that you got some of that same flexibility and the ability to make the last minute tweaks.
People, I don't know if people appreciate how important editors are. They really are. And I think with the push towards self-publishing, which, you know, I support self-publishing, but I think it should include editors.
Well, that's actually an interesting aspect there, because one of the questions I was curious about is how does one actually break into comics, because it's a field I know very little about other than the fact that I read in it. But, you know, given that so much of comic work is being done online now through, like, web comics and people doing their, like, DeviantArt pages and things like that, you know, we live in a sort of a very different time.
Yes.
So, I mean, like, what was the process for breaking in for you? You said initially that you'd started by working in children's books.
Yeah.
But how did you actually get to that point where you were doing children's books?
Actually, it's through my wife. She knew someone who knew someone. And which is funny, is my wife worked in science at the time, so it was so unrelated to to publishing. But that's how these things work. Someone asked me this on Twitter recently. Actually, no one asked me, but I said it anyway. I said that it's essential to know that there's no one route into publishing. You can get there through any door. It's really, and someone else has said this, but it's really staying in publishing that's the challenge. It's actually quite easy to get in these days, but to sustain a career and to keep putting out books is what's really difficult, really challenging.
Okay. All right. Mike, did you have any last processing questions? Or processing questions as opposed to process questions?
No, I could happily ask questions, ask your ear off about the nitty-gritty of the comics business, but can take that offline so we don't have a 90-minute episode.
It's all good.
Fair enough. So just something that just really quick. So you had mentioned that that Maddie and some of the characters within the novel had previously appeared in shorter work.
Yes.
Now, I haven't done extensive Google yet, but where can I consume those?
I don't think you'd find them. They might not come out until there's like an Art of Maddie book, because they were just little mini comics, like 10, 20 page mini comics that I sent out and have long since gone out of print. Little Xeroxed books, comics that I would just send out. I've barely published any of that stuff online. I really should. But it's just, it was just stuff that was just print.
Okay, you put them in a book, I will buy it.
Thank you.
Because I want more. I want to know where these characters began, and I want those little stories. It's just
I am really excited about getting those out, and I do think there's some really cool stuff in those early books too that I'd like people to see, because they're pretty strange when I look at them now, but they're kind of awesome.
Yeah, I think it'll be very interesting for readers to get a sense of who these characters were.
For
and
sure.
watch you learning who they are.
Yeah, and the design changed so dramatically. I look at the just so different.
Interesting. Well, okay, so we need to ask the wind down questions now.
Okay.
So the first is the most obvious question, which is, where can folks find you?
Oh, I am on Twitter at InkyBat at Twitter. On Twitter, and I own and operate ericorchard.com. So people can find me there. They can contact me through there. I'm on Facebook. I have there's a Maddie Kettle Facebook page as well as an Eric Orchard Facebook page. I have a Tumblr, The Bat Orchard. And I also have a second Tumblr, The Bat Orchard 2, where I put artwork that I really like that isn't mine. So there's lots of places you can find me.
Excellent. And of course, Maddie Kettle is available through Top Shelf, which you can get straight from their website.
Yeah. So, and bookstores.
That too?
Yep.
Also, I hear available
on... And it seems
like
you're...
Oh, it's okay, Mike. Go ahead. You just ruined my joke. It's cool.
Nope, go for it.
No, it's over now. I was going to say that it's also available on Jupiter, but, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but no, it's ruined now.
In a bookstore in the Cloudscape. It was awesome.
Oh,
okay. That's better than what I was going to say, so I'll let you get away with it.
Eric, I presume, are you working on another Maddie Kettle story right now?
I am, yeah. It's not really started yet, but we're sort of toying with the story right now, so that's where we're at there.
Excellent. Cool. Do you have any other work coming out that folks should be aware of?
Oh, well, not for a little while, because I'm working on a book for First Second. That's not out until 2016, and that's called Bera, the One-Headed Troll. And I'll be working on that for a while.
Okay, so that's a while away. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, excellent. Well, I do recommend that if folks are interested, if you've got kids in particular, get Maddie Kettle. and you can read it with your kids, or just get it for yourself and you can read it to yourself, which also works. Yeah. If you have a cat, you can read it to your cat. I don't know how much the cat will care, but
yeah. Read it in public so that people see you reading it. That's
that would
the
be cool. Yeah. That would be great. So, well, thank you very much, Eric, for giving us a chance to read this and for coming on and talking about it.
Well, thanks so much, guys. This is a blast. I love talking about Maddie Kettle, and you guys were great to chat with.
Yeah, well, we try. Yeah. You know, I mean, Mike, well, he's not as great. He's just a little less great. We're rivals, you know.
Yeah.
I have to make sure that he sounds good, because it's my job on this podcast to be wrong about comics.
Oh, right.
Yeah, surprisingly, we didn't argue at all, Mike.
We can fix it in post.
Just put some grumbles. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
This could be a sign of the apocalypse. Any case, so thanks again, Eric. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks a lot, guys. I had a really good time.
Absolutely. And thanks, Mike, for being my co-host on this one.
Hooray! This was fun.
Awesome. And on that note, awkward ending, and scene. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
From different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.